Opinions expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the management of Louisville.am and Veritas New Media, a Louisville.am production.
Hello and welcome to the official Louisville Improvisers Podcast. On today's show, we're talking with David Henry, co-author of Furious Cool, Richard Pryor and the World That Made Him. Now, here's Chris Anger.
Thank you, Alec. Wow, yeah, I stepped into a professional operation. God, wait, you walk out of the door for a couple of minutes. Anyway, thank you, Alec, for that wonderful introduction, and welcome, Dave.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Well, we're very excited to have you. It's a thrill and a privilege. So let's just Richard Pryor, you obviously, and this is the main thing, I'm a huge Richard Pryor fan. So if we could just – and you co-author with your brother, Joe.
Right.
Musician. Producer and actor. Well, we can get to that later.
Yes, he is now an actor.
So I mean, I love Richard Pryor. How did the book actually come about?
Well, I'll try and give you a short version of the long story. Besides being a Richard Pryor fan since I was, I remember seeing him on Ed Sullivan with my parents. I mean, I'm that old, but especially like when I was in junior high school, I'd see him on afternoon talk shows,
Mike Douglas.
Yeah, on Mike Douglas, and seeing him, but when he really, the breakthrough was when his LPs came out.
Yeah,
And I first heard those probably, I had, at friends' houses, who had older siblings. And it's kind of funny how many as much as I love music, how many of the first LPs I bought were comedy LPs. I think because they were things you couldn't hear on the radio. The George Carlin, Richard Pryor, certainly. Never heard any of that on the radio. But how the book came about is, being a lifelong, he was just really important person to me. For some, he's just one of those galvanizing people. There are a handful of them for me, Bob Dylan. I remember when I first heard Bob Dylan, and same thing with Richard Pryor. Even though I already knew who he was, the first time I heard one of his LPs, that was just it. And it's sort of my inclination, one that I share with my brother. I guess is when I'm really taken by somebody like that, I start digging into who they, where they came from and more about them. And I use the example of Bob Dylan or somebody, as soon as that leads you right to Woody Guthrie, to Lead Belly and all the country blues and all the old weird America folk songs and things. So it's but my brother wrote a song about in the year 2000 called Richard Pryor Addresses a Tearful Nation. It's one of those songs that just came out. Richard Pryor's name is not mentioned in the song, but that's the title that tells you how to hear it. It's kind of a dirgeful blues, and he actually ended up getting the great saxophonist Ornette Coleman to play on it. And his record company at the time said had just been bought by Disney. He was on a small label, but they said, you have to get Richard Pryor's permission to use his name in the song. He said, well, no, you don't. He's a public figure. But Richard Pryor is such a volatile character, I think they were frightened of it. He actually had another song on the album called Edgar Bergen, and nobody said, you have to go to Candace Bergen and get her permission.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got to go through Mortimer Schnurd to get to Edgar.
Right, that's right. Mortimer's going to be pissed.
Yeah, he's litigious, so that's the one thing I know about Mortimer Schnurd. But anyway.
Yeah, but So he wrote the song, and he through people he knows, he's had a long time close relationship with friendship with the producer T-Bone Burnett.
Oh yeah,
who knows everybody. Mm-hmm. And he was just out at dinner one night, and he said, "Does anybody know how I can get a hold of Richard Pryor?" And he's like, "Joey, I'm your godfather. I know Jennifer Lee Pryor from way back." Anyway, so he got
you should have come to me first.
Yeah, why didn't you come to me first? Why didn't you talk to these lawyers? So he got the song to Richard Pryor. He and his wife both liked it. They said, sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in the meantime, Esquire magazine for something asked him to write a piece about how he came to write a song about Richard Pryor and how Ornette Coleman happened to play on it. It's just a And so he wrote a, you know, a really – he's a very good writer.
Oh, amazing.
He writes great liner notes for his CDs he produces. And so this is a long story, I know.
No, I love it.
But it's getting close.
Yeah.
So they said to him they really liked the Esquire, Richard Pryor. At that time, Richard Pryor could barely speak. We met – my brother spent time with him, bring records over. They'd listen to talk. But it was very difficult for him to talk. Mm-hmm. He had pretty much facial paralysis. But his eyes were completely alive. I mean, mm-hmm. he was definitely taking part in an exchange.
You know? Right.
It's just a shame to be sitting with Richard Pryor and having to do all the talking.
Yeah.
But he would go, or sometimes lean back and give you that, what's this motherfucker talking? Yeah. But he was like, so they said to my brother, they said, we think it's time. People have asked us about, doing a movie about Richard's life. And we mm-hmm. think it's, he feels like it's about time. Would you like to work on a screenplay? They didn't offer any money or anything.
So, right.
But
right. Would you like to write one?
Yeah, or something like that. And Joe says, well, no, I'm not a screenwriter. And he says, no, we don't want a screenwriter. We want, they liked what he had written in the Esquire piece. And he said, well, my brother writes screenplays. I need his, So we said, sure, we'd take a crack at it.
Yeah.
So as things go with most film projects, and, it ran into one snag after another, and then people fall out and people fall through. So we did, we had it. That's a whole long involved story, and it's kind of unremarkable because that happens to so many movies. I mean,
absolutely.
Leonardo DiCaprio has a movie he wants to make. It takes him 10 years and he goes through half a dozen producers.
Right.
So,
yeah.
At a certain point, we're getting close to the end of the story. At a certain point, just a few years ago, I said, who knows if this will ever turn into anything, but we've done a lot of research and kind of gone back to Richard Pryor's beginnings and things that wouldn't really fit into a three-act screenplay structure. And so why don't we just write a book and we can mm-hmm. say what we want to say and
right.
put everything in it we want in it. So we did. It kind of worked out and spent a good bit of time putting the proposal together. Which is a good idea anyway. So you know what you're doing.
Right.
But we actually, it didn't take long to get hooked up with a very good publisher. Algonquin Books or Chapel Hill, and they've been great.
Yeah, that's great. So did you give them you just pitched them and then they
couple sample chapters or parts of uh-huh. a couple of chapters from different and a pretty thorough outline and they kind of went for it right away.
Well, I mean, that's great. No, and by the way, I love the story. And don't you can talk as long as you want.
Okay.
Because this is all very interesting to me. And I know Alec. Yeah, he his eyes are open, so he's listening. I don't know what I want to say. So how long, how long did it take?
Well, to write the book, it took about 18 months.
That ain't bad.
Between 18 months and two. Yeah. Even though we had already written like three drafts of a full screenplay and we drew on some of that and certainly some of the research, but it was a very different thing. It's not like there was a whole lot we could copy and paste from the screenplay into the book, so we did have a good leg up on the research.
Yeah.
But we started over. We did start to talk to a lot more people, and
colleagues
of his.
Fellow comedians.
We talked to Franklin Ajayi, a great comedian from his
absolutely.
Era, who's most recently seen on Deadwood. Right. And no longer has the big fro.
Oh, I love that. Oh yeah.
And David Brenner and Richard Lewis and people like that who just idolize him.
Paul
we
Mooney.
Also we never actually talked to Paul Mooney.
Oh really?
He wrote a book and we quote from his book and he's given many interviews and about Richard Pryor and talked a lot about Richard Pryor, but it was just very difficult to pin him down. He actually did take part in a couple of meetings, I think, for one draft of our screenplay, which I was not present for, but he was there with this there are a couple of directors who were interested in
you want to name them?
Well, Robert Townsend was interested for a time, and uh-huh. he brought in he kind of brought Paul Mooney to a couple of meetings, and,
right?
And there were some others, but
Paul Schrader. James Cameron. Yeah, right. Well, Richard Pryor was in a Paul Schrader movie.
Yes, he was. Blue Collar is one of my favorites. I think Richard Pryor is great as a dramatic actor. I think anybody who does, like, you do improv and stuff, to be a comic, you have to, I think, is a lot more difficult than
comedy's easy. Dying's hard.
Dying, yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's the other way around, dude.
Dying
is easy. Comedy
Alex,
is hard.
Well, first of all, Alex not that funny, which is why he fucked up the quote.
I think of Jackie Gleason in The Hustler or things like that.
Absolutely.
There's something about, I think to be a comic, you have to be really smart. And to be a solo performer on stage
especially
if you do the kind of comedy that Richard Pryor did, where he so immerses himself into these characters, and not only characters that he's playing on stage, he becomes his heart trying to kill him when he's having a heart attack. He becomes the tires of his wife's car when he shoots them out, and he's dogs, and he's,
That was one of my favorites. What was that? Was that like, that was I always love Richard Pryor, but I think, 77? I mean, when you put it, was it like Wanted?
That was 79.
79, but it was his first
79 tour.
Whenever he was talking about, whenever the heart attack thing, because I have the record, and that's the other thing, too, just to back up. I mean, I mean, Mike grew up loving comedy, so I have like old Bob Newhart records and Bob and Ray.
Oh, yeah, Bob and Ray are favorites of mine. Well,
just a name drop again. And Joe Henry wrote a song with Bob and Ray.
He wrote a song about Bob and with Bob and Ray in the title. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I was telling somebody the other day about that. One of their things about the owner of the paperclip factory. I don't know if you know the ones where they're interviewing the guy, and he's like, they get paid 3 cents a box for making 100. Anyway, says, how can you live on this? Well, we don't like to pry into the lives of our employees.
I went Bob and Ray because then he was like, because then it's the whole bit, It's kind of like he says, I'll never forget it. It's like it happened yesterday, because there's some horrible traumatic incident. You know what I mean? And he says, "Well, why don't you tell us about it?" He said, "It was Thursday." Yeah, it was Thursday. Bob and Ray for sure.
Bob and Ray is like, Fireside Theater or something. Like you start doing lines. You're here all day. I had a math teacher once. We could get him to waste the whole class by asking him if he saw Monty Python the night before, and he would take him 45 minutes to reenact the half-hour episode of Monty Python.
Oh God, yeah, that was great. You got the book, and you talked to a bunch of people. I guess, did you talk to the ex-wives?
Mm-hmm. Talked to his children. We talked to his...
Yeah, his children.
And talked to his... one great interview was with his... the sister of his first wife in Peoria, who they got married when he was very, 19, right when he's back. And she had some really good stories about him. He'd lived at their house with them and just, and his refusal to get a job, and that he knew what he wanted to do, but he wasn't sure how he would get there.
Right.
He would or that her father just insisted that he go apply for it. They were hiring at the hospital. So he went off to the pool hall, and he came back and said, "Pops, they were closed."
Well, when did he know? I mean, because he's one of these guys, and the two that I can name off the top of my head, Richard Pryor and George Carlin, where they're making a living and they're doing stand-up, and I don't know if they both had this epiphany in Las Vegas, but, they're doing that fucking, they're making money and they're doing great gigs, but, they got the suit and the tie and performing for, opening for fucking, Victor Borga or whatever, you know what I mean? Or, God, anyway.
They both had, the moment in, George Carlin was fired famously for saying shit.
Oh, yeah, right. But so when did Richard Pryor know he wanted to be a comic?
Well, I think he knew he wanted to be – he wanted to be a movie star when he was a kid.
Originally.
He had a very brutal upbringing, growing up in his grandmother's brothel, and his mother was a prostitute in the brothel. And he was molested by a neighborhood bully, serially molested by this. Just a lot of abuse. And I don't think – and even though his father had been a vaudeville singer for a time – and Peoria was actually a real show business town. It was for the Chitlin Circuit and the Toba. The vaudeville troops would stop in Peoria between St. Louis and Chicago. It was Will It Play in Peoria was a real thing. It's not just a marketer's you know, yeah. conceit, you know, will they like it in the sticks? It was really, of course, they'll get it in St. Louis and Chicago and New York. But if you've got an act that'll also play in Peoria, you've got, you know. But this woman's Juliette Whitaker, she started a theater program at a youth center in Peoria. And he came in and she said he was probably 13. He looked like he was about 9.
Yeah.
And they were and he wanted to be – but they'd already cast the show. It was Rumpelstiltskin. And they made him a townsperson or a court servant or something. And one day the kid who played the king didn't show up. And so he said, me, let me, you know, be the stand-in today. He knew, the whole part. He knew everybody's
right.
part, she said. And what he did with this role just killed everybody. And when the kid who played the king came back, he agreed. He said, you know, let him have it.
He's Wally Pipp.
Yeah.
Right. Wally Pipp of Rumpelstiltskin. Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, I think his family, his father, you know, they didn't, even though they liked music halls and you know, obviously they had you know, piano players in the Rumpel, mm-hmm. I think, or many did. I'm not sure.
Well, he ended up playing. Wasn't he like in Lady Sings the Blues?
He modeled that after a guy I talked to who's still around, and I have to pull up in the book. I'm drawing a blank on his name. Oh, he had like one hit for. I'm not going to think of his name at the moment. If I pulled out the book, I could find it real quick. But he's a guy who still plays like piano bar at a steakhouse in Peoria.
I mean, to this day.
Well, at least as of 2 years ago.
Yeah. I'm sure he's still
gigging. When I talked to him. But yeah, Richard Pryor based the piano man on this guy. But I think, you know, being in theater for his people, was probably a little bit swishy. You know, not being in a music hall, doing like – but – so he'd have to kind of like play hooky from theater and have Miss Carver come find him in the pool hall where he'd be working – he actually worked sweeping up in a strip club, and that's when he was fairly young too.
Yeah.
But you know, she'd have to come like drag him out, even though he wanted to be dragged out.
Right.
Sometimes he had to, he had to work both those worlds, and I think that was something that was like a permanent thing for him, being a black man at the time he wanted to be very successful, and you get like that kind of Hollywood or he started to feel less authentic. I mean, his whole thing was bringing like the. You know, the tall tales and the mother rhymes and the street humor and that kind of like who was it? I'm drawing blanks on names.
That's okay.
Ellison, author of Invisible Man, said, you know, he kind of, you know, there's this humor that's just for us. You know, it's part of the pool halls, the barbershop, the back porch. And Richard Pryor went out and started doing it in front of everybody. And even when he did his short-lived 1977 TV series,
which I actually watched, I remember when it came on. Absolutely,
yeah, I remember too. And I talked to that's another great subject for our interviewee for us was Rocco Urbisi, who directed all those.
Four
episodes. Richard somehow thought he was signing deals left and right. He had like big deal with Columbia, big deal with. Warner Brothers to star or develop his properties, and then he was just being handed things to sign left and right at that point. He thought he was signing to do a series of specials till he got to like the big industry press day, and they called and he said, "You know, you're starting this series for NBC." And he says, "No, I'm doing some specials." And they said, "Paul Richard, you're doing a series."
Yeah.
It's just like, and for somebody like him, his friend Paul Mooney said he just was not equipped to. Or he said he couldn't give up his cocaine that much to write, produce, star in a weekly hour-long variety show, and especially have it be confident that he could deliver. Be confident that he could deliver something that he would be proud of,
right?
But especially with the restraints on TV. Plus, it was supposed to be a 10 p.m. show, and they ended up moving it to 8 p.m. opposite Laverne and Shirley, and which was a
big.
One of the top rated shows at the time. So they sort of flushed it. But
yeah.
They also just sort of let him do whatever he wanted to. He, besides the controversial opening of the first show where he appeared as if naked with no genitalia, where he says, you know, if people ask me how I can do a TV show, will I have to compromise? Will I have to give? I've given up nothing. And they pull back and he's got no dick or balls. But NBC censored that. But NBC News and every other network aired it that night. This is the scene that was cut from the Richard Pryor show. So.
Right.
Yeah. It's a business.
Yeah. So, but I think that the point they also just let him, they just sort of renegotiated down, you'll do four episodes. And that, so just let him do his thing and get him out of here.
Yeah.
I mean, they did some really wild stuff on that show.
Absolutely.
And very, I mean, a lot of it was very cinematic, too. I mean, long, atmospheric intros into these. I'm thinking of one in particular where he played a Cajun sort of faith healer called named Bojaws, which Robin Williams was in. I think that was one of his first TV appearances.
Yeah. He was friends with him. Yeah.
But yeah, this faith is like, you know. But they did some, they really did some wild stuff on that show. And Rocco Urbisi told me, he says, I think we just didn't know any better. We didn't, you know. I never really asked him how he happened to get that job. He produced almost all of George Carlin's HBO specials later, and he did JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling. He co-wrote and co-produced that. But I think somehow or other he and Richard Pryor hit it off, and he was tapped to be the producer of that show. But that was his first really big job. I'm not sure quite how he made it sound like he just sort of fell into it.
Ran into Richard. Well, yeah. It was amazing. I mean, and that's the whole thing. It just sort of, you know, the thing I was thinking when you were talking, you know, because I loved his stand-up movies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just in terms of him being a stand-up comic. And you know, like, I mean, I got the comedy records, and I love Bob and Ray and Carlin and Bob Newhart, you know, the button-down line and all kinds of stuff like that. But I guess it was, you know, when he started doing those stand-up movies and it was just like, holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was funny, but it was kind of, I don't know if he was the first or not, but it was real, and it was really funny. It was realer than anybody, and it was funnier than anybody, and it was just amazing. I just went, oh, God. You know, because I've loved comedy since I was a kid, and you know, I've done, you know, improv and comedy since high school, but you see something like that, and it's kind of like, all right.
Yeah.
It would be nice if I could do that, but fuck, you know, yeah. Jesus.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that people have asked me, you know, as we've done other interviews. Is there anything
I'm sorry, you've done other interviews?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You're not my,
we weren't your
sorry,
first
this
stop?
Is not your first, my first time.
Okay, well, then, no, thank you.
But no, but people said, and I hadn't thought about this before, really, for even though it's such an obvious question, this, is there anything you found out doing all this that really surprised you about Richard Pryor?
I swear to God, I thought that earlier, but I got sidetracked.
I knew it was coming, but you know, because his life was—he just—I mean, he used everything in his life, no matter, you know, whether it's heart attack, setting himself on fire, shooting up his wife's car. I mean, there was nothing he wouldn't. There was nowhere he wouldn't go.
Right.
And but I think the thing that really surprised me was how, hearing from other comedians, was how much of a craftsman he was. How hard he worked at it. I mean, I knew he'd been around, you know, by the time he became, you know, say you get to Stir Crazy or something, where he really becomes like the big, one of the highest paid people in Hollywood, he'd been doing it for 20 years.
Right.
You know, from the Chitlin Circuit to he arrived in Greenwich Village in 1963, where Buck Henry said you could see him, George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Bill Cosby, Bob Dylan, all, you know, working within a few square blocks.
Right.
Yeah, you know, on the same night. He says, you walk down, and it'd be great to do that, to see a walking video of all the people who were later famous.
Yeah,
But anyway, but yeah, people talk about Franklin Ajayi told me that he used to go to the Comedy Store. Like whenever Richard Pryor, as early as maybe 72, 73, if he wanted to workshop something, Mitzi Shore at the Comedy Store would just clear the decks and say, yeah.
You're not going on, Richard's here?
Everybody had to give up their slots. But he said, you know, it was great because even by that time, everybody could see that he was the best guy around. You know, he was the best guy doing this. And they would just – everybody would show up to watch him do his thing. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, one night – I was there every night for a week. And he was doing this thing. And all of a sudden, this old man came out and just made – you know, said a line or two. And he said it really impressed me because every night he would at some point he'd bring this character back out and have a little more. You could tell he'd been working it during the day and thinking about it. And he said by the end of the week he did like that whole 20-minute Mudbone routine that he did on his next LP.
Mm.
He says, you know, he saw him just like create this character just over the course of a week. And said, you know, just was for his – he said, you know, I always thought Richard Pryor – he said, yeah, I admired him as a comic. I thought he was the best, but – I didn't like to hang out with him. I didn't like him. He said, you know, I thought there was nothing he could teach me about the business or about life or, you know,
right.
no real life skills to share. But it's funny, like, that was the thing that, you know, that really just that I was aware of, I think, very from my teens, just how all knowing he seemed to be just on stage by himself, but really had no ability to apply that kind of clear sightedness or, you know, to his own life, which is not unusual, I guess, for somebody of that. I mean, I think somebody's a genius like that, they're just not normal people. I mean, to varying degrees. I mean, we all know very artistic people who are, I hope I'm not offending anyone.
No,
but
no,
you're just like,
No. I don't even know how to do my own laundry, so just, I must be a fucking genius.
Who are just an absolute mess.
Well, I know it's true. Well, I mean, this is totally unrelated, except that I've watched these movies recently. I love music and I love comedy. They're like one of my favorite things. And I've watched three documentaries recently, which I've seen a couple of them before. One on Towns Van Zandt. And went on the band Big Star. And then I just watched one of the guys at Wild and Willie, give them a plug. Great store. On this guy, Blaze Foley. He was a songwriter. And he wrote, If I Can Only Fly, which, you know, but the guy was homeless, basically. But he'd sleep on people's couches. And he wrote, If I Can Only Fly, which Merle Haggard did a couple of times. But none of these guys came out like, well, Big Star, I mean, they're just, you know, shoot themselves in the foot. And Towns Van Zandt was always sabotaging everything. I mean, you know, he's as good a songwriter as there is, you know. And then, but, I mean, motherfucker, you know what I mean? He just he couldn't do shit, you know, and just probably living somewhere without any heat. But, you know, he had the gig. So just to tie into that, you know, I mean, yeah, I wish I. I mean, unfortunately, I know how to drive a car and do my laundry and go to Kroger, so I must not be a genius. but, you know, and prior, this is one, but I think he was. It's kind of interesting because, I mean, as brilliant a stand-up comic as he was, and he was as good as there ever was, just in terms of, getting the material of his life and just sort of making it real and funny. And he was a great actor. But, I mean, there's movies. I've never seen Stir Crazy all the way through.
I have seen Stir Crazy, but there's a part in the book where we just sort of confess. They're like almost everything after.
It's unwatchable.
Yeah, I've never seen them all the way through. Maybe I've seen all of Harlem Nights just from catching it on TV over the years, parts of it. But it's just too painful. We even say, like, that guy who calls himself Richard Pryor is an imposter. Yeah, it's like – it's funny. He's just not the same – he did as many movies with Billy Dee Williams as he did with Gene Wilder early on, which is fun. And you could see they had a good rapport. I don't know how well they got along offset, but
it's Bingo Long, right?
But he could do
Bingo Long. Well, Lady Sings the Blues too.
Yeah. Richard Fury's movie Hit, which I think is great. It's like it didn't do well, but it's like it's very European in some ways in the direction and sensibility. And it's like, I don't know, an hour and a half of setup and 20 minutes of action. And it was billed as an action film.
Yeah, we're getting there. Don't worry. Yeah, don't worry.
A lot of character development, but it's fun. It's great to watch.
A lot of exposition.
But David Brenner told Ed Franklin and Jai and a couple other people said, you know, he just could not, even though he wanted to be a movie star. To me, it's almost like Elvis Presley. Yeah, almost used. He was absolutely genius at doing this one thing, but he really wanted to make just a movie star as being the that's the pinnacle, or it was at the time. I guess it still is.
I mean,
depending on the movie. I mean, movies are much easier to make now. I mean, you can still. I mean, as far as the money it takes to David Lynch shot his last one on what looked like an iPhone, but.
Yeah.
But he said, you know, Richard Pryor would do this thing when he was brilliant as a stand-up comic. He would completely immerse himself in this character and go wherever that character needed to go or wanted to go. And he said he really was just really being hamstrung to try and have to do somebody else's script, hit his mark. Even in, famously, in Blue Collar, he did improvise a lot, but there was such rivalry between him and Harvey Keitel and Yaphet Kotto, who all thought they were being hired in the leading role. There's a story where he said, yeah, he just really, with the exception of maybe Lily Tomlin or something, there was nobody who could play in his league.
Yeah.
And who, you know, by the time he finished improvising, the next line of the script's not going to make any sense. And, you know, never mind hitting your mark and doing movies that were kind of like poor, bad ideas to begin with.
Right. Yeah, I was just trying to visualize Harvey Keitel as an improviser.
Well, he said there's...
He did. The Paul Green movie in Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah,
Up in Smoke. Yeah.
Up in Smoke. Did
you ever see that first?
Paul Auster? Paul Auster. Oh.
Yeah. Did you ever see that first Scorsese film, Who's That Knocking at My Door?
Well, I did. I guess he was. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of... That's got to be a lot of improv.
Okay.
Yeah.
Harvey, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but he said there was this one scene in Paul Schrader said there's this one scene in Blue Collar where... They're all in the bar, you know, the Detroit auto workers in the bar with the stamped aluminum ashtray. Anyway, he says, Richard Pryor went off on this just incredible rant. And he says, I just couldn't believe what I was getting on. And Harvey Keitel was just getting so pissed. He picked up one of these ashtrays and just threw it right in the camera and then left. I mean, as in went to the airport and got on a plane.
He didn't just leave set.
He left town.
He left,
well, it wasn't Detroit. I think they shot at a cab assembly lot. Plant in Kalamazoo or something, but you know, it's supposed to be. Yeah.
We're at 30.
Well, we're good.
I can stop.
No, we don't want you to stop because we have so much more to talk about. Well, let's just say, I mean, that's great, and the title of the book is Furious Cool. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Dave Henry with us. And while we're at it, so you're actually from. Michigan, Detroit. Are you from Detroit?
Not originally. Originally from North Carolina.
Okay.
Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
And my dad is a retired Chevrolet guy, but during his working years, every time there was an opening, it was in a different city. So we lived Charlotte, Decatur, Georgia, outside of Atlanta, then outside of Cincinnati,
okay.
Akron, then ended up in Michigan.
Okay, you ended up in Michigan, and then you ended up in Louisville.
Right. I went. My brother and I actually both moved to New York
together
after college. Yeah, we actually
roommates
shared an apartment for a while with a couple other musicians.
Okay. Now, are you a musician?
No.
Okay.
I tried to be for a while, but
did you?
My brother's younger than me, and he asked me to show him some chords, and he was running circles around me within a couple weeks. I think I'm going to focus on writing or something else.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Maybe photography.
Finger painting.
Which I liked doing for a while, yeah.
Yeah, so you did shots of pictures. So now you're a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm. And a advertising marketing writer by day.
Okay, by day. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, as a screenwriter, I mean, now you just, there is a movie shot in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
What? Last year? Two years ago?
Like a year and a half ago, actually. We just made a deal.
You just made a deal?
Virgil Films.
To distribute it? Cool. Right.
They're good. I haven't seen their whole plan, but they did Supersize Me. And
oh, yeah. Okay.
And they've distributed several music-themed movies, which this is.
And it's called Pleased to Meet Me.
Mm-hmm.
Is it named after the Replacement song?
It doesn't really have anything to. I mean, the Replacements are mentioned, but it's certainly referencing the Replacements. Okay. But it's not the movie's nothing about them.
Okay, and this is totally off the subject, but well, it's Replacements related. Mm-hmm. I've heard the Replacements. I just want to say, for the record, that if you call the band the Replacements and it's just Paul Westerberg and Tommy mm-hmm. Stinson, it's not the Replacements. Okay.
Okay.
I just want to go on record as saying that. I love him. I love Paul Westerberg. I've seen him. It's not the Replacement.
Well, Slim can't play. I guess
he had a stroke or something.
Stroke, yeah. So. Yeah.
And then Bob, may he rest in peace, Bob Stinson.
Yeah, we haven't seen him in a while.
No. So Pleased to Meet Me now. You got like a star, like a musical cast.
Yes. It's based on an episode of This American Life. By Starley Kine as the producer and John Langford of the Mekons.
He
actually has a small part in the movie.
Oh, really?
He's tending bar at the Knock Bar in our movie.
In town, okay. Yeah.
So it was all shot in Louisville. And my friend Archie Borders, he bought the rights to the story after it aired on This American Life. And he worked on it for quite a while, had different investors who fell through. you know, guy gets a divorce, his assets are frozen or whatever. Right. That's what they say anyway.
That's a story.
So I took the script on and did a couple rewrites,
mm-hmm.
and got my brother involved.
Yeah.
He's a producer. So I sent him the script because we thought, you know, we had a part in mind. We thought he could
play.
Mm-hmm. He didn't want to. He said he didn't think he was enough of an actor. He didn't want to make a fool of himself.
Yeah, so, boy. We don't have that problem, do we, Alec?
You don't want to be an actor if you're not willing to make a. He didn't want to do it. You know, he didn't want to suck. He said,
"Yeah, right."
So well, but he does have a sizable role. He took a dip. But his wife, he's a producer. He's produced lots of great people.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
His wife said, "What about John Doe? Because he is he's you know,
I love John Doe.
He's been in several things." And he agreed to do it. And then from there, Amy Mann, who my brother's also friends with and has produced a record of hers, she came on. Karen Berkowitz from Over the Rhine.
Yeah.
Is great in the movie. Loudon Wainwright III.
Yeah, absolutely.
My brother's worked with him. And he actually studied acting in high school and college.
He's great. I love Loudon Wainwright. I love his music.
From MASH. And,
yeah. Absolutely. I was just
and he and my brother worked together on the score for Knocked Up. Because
oh, yeah?
Because
Yeah. Well, and Loudon Wainwright was in the movie.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Right.
He played the
father,
the obstetrician.
Oh, the obstetrician. Obstetrician. He was the dog, yeah, who didn't show up.
Right.
Oh, but spoiler alert! Sorry.
Yeah, you should say that.
So yeah, okay, and then and that's great. Well,
so
yeah.
So we shot it. It was like 3 weeks. Most of it takes place in a recording studio.
Mm-hmm.
The premise is this producer who Amy Mann plays.
Mm-hmm.
She just has the idea of putting together a band for one day to record one song of musicians of different styles who wouldn't – people advertising in the classifieds or Craigslist. You know, it's kind of a – her premise, Starley Kind, who actually produced the radio show, you know, her premise was it's sort of like a Lonely Hearts column. You see drummer seeks band, then you see band right. seeks drummer. It's like – so that's – so we just took that as the premise, and of course it's totally fiction. It was a documentary for a
right.
story on This American Life, but –
just use the basis for the story.
Just use the basis. I can't compare it to an Altman film, really. But, you know, these little – just within the studio and the musicians and engineers.
So it's
– they sort of pair off, have their little intrigues and encounters during the course of the day as they
– so it takes place over one day?
Pretty much. There's a
Altman-esque?
Bit, yeah.
Like Nashville?
Like Nashville.
I love – I love
Help.
Or Health. I never saw Health. Lauren Bacall and Health, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I saw part of it.
Carol Burnett.
I remember. Was it Carol Burnett?
Carol Burnett. She was from Louisville.
Was she really?
Yeah.
In the character.
And there was a wedding that was up in Chicago.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Alec Bowles.
Yeah, it's one of the few Altman films I've never seen.
They just came out the Criterion Collection on Nashville or something, and so I just watched it again a few weeks ago. I mean, just an amazing movie.
It's one of my all-time favorites. Henry Gibson was great.
He was so good.
That Bicentennial song he wrote for that.
Oh God, that was amazing.
They all wrote the songs, right? Didn't Ronnie Blankey write some of her?
Yeah. And Keith Carradine. I'm Easy, for God's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a hit.
Yeah,
I mean, for God's sakes.
Yeah, but
so,
yeah. So the movie is we're having a premiere at the Kentucky Center on February 15th.
Okay, so mark your calendars.
John Doe will be there.
He will.
We're trying to get it. See if a few other cast members can make it. Karen Berkowitz of Over the Rhine will be there.
Okay, so John Doe's going to be there, and he confirmed
today that he will definitely be there,
and he'll be in town to do our podcast. So I guess I might as well ask you formally.
Sure.
Yeah, Dave.
If I'm driving him out,
drop him off, man.
Out here.
John, we're going to make a quick stop. Well, and of course you can tell. I saw X at the Berkeley Square, right after their first album came out. Wow. I saw X, and it was just amazing. You know, there was like, I don't know, there were probably like 70 people there. And then, that was amazing. And then and Billy Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
Coolest man in rock and roll who just stands there, doesn't move. Anyway, I love X.
I just saw them in Cincinnati up by what's that place by the river?
Are you talking about the not the club?
Up river. Yeah, it's like up the river a little ways. Is it not
in Newport, that place?
Riverbend.
Riverbend, is that it?
Yeah,
like a little outdoor shell.
Yeah, that's Riverbend.
Yeah, Riverbend.
It used to be Coney Island.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Used to be Coney Island.
They were opening for somebody?
They were opening for Blondie.
Okay, well, I could talk all day because I saw Rockpile open for Blondie, and I met Nick Lowe after the show. And, yeah, I'm going to name drop. That's what the show's about. Yeah. And I go, and I said to him, Nick, opening for Blondie? And he's just like, yeah, you know.
Yeah, it was on 9/11. How about that? I forgot.
Oh, yeah. Outstanding.
I keep picking up my wife's laptop, so I've just started slapping random stickers.
Outstanding. Yeah, well, for the record, Dave just showed me his pass for the Blondie X thing. But they can still play, man.
Yeah, they're still together. Still all four original.
That's
DJ
amazing.
Bone Break on drums and Billy Zoom on guitar, Xene and John.
Did Billy Zoom still do the same thing where he doesn't move?
Mm-hmm.
Just stands there with his legs spread apart?
Yeah.
I mean, first time I saw him, does he still wear the spray-painted leather jacket? Silver spray-painted leather jacket.
He was wearing a bright jacket.
Okay.
But
it's a big room.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, thanks again. This is amazing. Do you have any questions for us? Since we was up... Yeah, that's what we do. We like to end the show by putting somebody on the spot.
Well, that's good. I shouldn't be just answering all the questions. It's like a one-sided relationship.
But I did actually have one question.
So,
go ahead.
Where do you guys usually – do you have a regular thing? Because I know I see – I don't get out enough. I don't get out enough. As you know, we have – well, Thea is our youngest of two. But it seems like we just got into this thing where it's just like – plus I write at night.
Yeah, is that
but
when you
really? But we're really starting to emerge from our from our nest.
Oh gosh,
and go out more often. And it's like I have all these people I know are doing like great things. I know a few people in improv. Do you know JP Liebengood?
I do know JP. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I keep promising I'm going to come see his stuff, and we try and make it out to shows. And so yeah, where can I see?
Well,
you guys? I do want to see because I obviously know all your Walden.
Yeah, Alec Voles works at Walden Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Give them a plug.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, that's enough of that. Anyway, and I teach part-time at Walden Theater. Enough of that. But our next show is actually on January 17th, coming up next Friday night. And it's actually an early show for us at 8 o'clock at the Bardstown.
Okay.
And this is going to be our show. It's called the Dirty Fucking Improv Show, just because we like the title. And then that's going to be 8 o'clock at Bardstown, corner of Speed and Bardstown Road. Wonderful place. Great friends, Doug, Scott, and John, I think his name is, run a wonderful place. And that's... And we'll do our traditional Louisville improviser show with our, and then we do a monthly show. So we'll have another show if you can't make that one, which I know you'll be there.
Yeah. What's the monthly show?
It's always at the Bardstown.
Oh, it's at the bar. Okay.
Yeah, and then the next one I think we're gonna have a Valentine's Day show on February 14th.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to do a monthly show, just to, you know, showcase what we're doing, and we've been at it, and this is actually going to be our 15th year.
Wow.
Of Louisville Improvisers. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're going to, you know, get out there doing it and just kind of just having some fun.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing the magic to the people, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's what we call it. Well, Dave, thanks again for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And look forward to seeing the movie when it comes out. I guess you're going to have a premiere, and is it going to play in Louisville after the premiere? Or
Well, we'd have a – I'm not sure what the schedule is.
Okay.
What the plan is. We are definitely having like a big event at
okay.
the Kentucky Center the night after your show.
Okay.
Ours will be the 15th. And then on the 16th, we'll be Do It Again in Lexington.
Okay.
With a after party, I think, at Natasha's.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Natasha's Bistro.
Yes. That's the one. Yeah.
Okay. That sounds good.
And
okay.
Then, it'll be streaming. It'll be something. I'm not sure. Our distributor, Virgil Films, has a plan, and I haven't paid as much attention to those emails as I should.
Well, you've been prepping for this show,
I've been practicing in front of the full-length mirror.
I got to do that podcast. Okay, well, what happens next? We'll find out next time. Police!